Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pandemics, a very short introduction, by Christian W. McMillan. Narrated by Joe Barrett. Introduction. This book will introduce listeners to the rich history of pandemic and epidemic disease and suggest that much of the way we confront such things now has been shaped by the past. This is an unremarkable statement, but an important point, for very often history is forgotten or rediscovered only when we confront contemporary epidemics and pandemics, and thus patterns from the past are repeated thoughtlessly. What are pandemics and epidemics? An epidemic is generally considered to be an unexpected, widespread rise in disease incidence at a given time. A pandemic is best thought of as a very large epidemic. Ebola in 2014 was by any measure an epidemic, perhaps even a pandemic. The influenza that killed 50 million people around the world in 1918 was a pandemic. A common way to think about epidemics and pandemics is as events. They come and they go. But if we think about them this way, can we call HIV/AIDS a pandemic? Or tuberculosis? What about malaria? Pandemics can be either discrete events or what I would like to call persistent pandemics. Tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS, which affect enormous swaths of the globe and kill millions and millions each year, are persistent pandemics. In the wake of the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, controversy emerged over the definition of pandemics used by the World Health Organization, WHO, and others. In response, several infectious disease specialists at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, came up with a broad framework that can work to help define what a pandemic is and has been. They suggested that it must meet 8 criteria: wide geographic extension, disease movement, high attack rates and explosiveness, minimal population immunity, novelty, infectiousness, contagiousness, and severity. It might seem that TB, HIV/AIDS, and malaria are not novel, but their profiles change. TB gets worse in one area, then better in another. XDR-TB emerges, and they become novel again. Each particular historical context is novel. Malaria took on a new identity in the 1950s, when the WHO attempted to eradicate it. It took on another in the 1970s and 1980s, as the World Bank became the major player in global health. Likewise with HIV/AIDS, its identity has changed so much over time that it has taken on multiple novel identities, each one historically contingent. A death sentence, a chronic and manageable infection, a gay disease, a heterosexual disease. There are a number of themes and topics that link the history of epidemics and pandemics. The identities of each disease underwent significant change as a result of the late 19th century laboratory revolution, a revolution that ushered in the age of modern medicine in which we now live. What began with Louis Pasteur in France and culminated with the work of Robert Koch in Germany meant that diseases, once explained in myriad ways, were forever thereafter explained by one. The consequences of this change cannot be overstated. The discovery of bacteria as the cause of diseases such as tuberculosis meant that centuries-old explanations for disease etiology vanished. For the first time, medical science actually knew what caused a given disease. Diseases might actually be able to be cured. The discovery of the tubercle bacillus and the bacteria that caused plague allowed medicine to develop effective therapies, as well as understand how to prevent infections. But the laboratory revolution also cultivated an undue amount of confidence in the power of biomedicine to rid the world of infectious diseases, and fostered the belief that the way to do so was far more dependent on attacking germs than on attacking the social conditions that gave rise to disease in the first place. This points to another pair of themes: the relationship between poverty and disease, and the geography of epidemics and pandemics. All of the diseases discussed in this book, while able to be controlled to varying degrees by modern medicine, are affected by social conditions. That is, there is a reason cholera disappeared from the United States more than a century ago, but is still present in much of the developing world, or that HIV/AIDS disproportionately affects sub-Saharan Africa, or that plague was worse among the poor than the rich during Marseille's 1720 epidemic. Some places have been able to transcend the conditions that allow infectious diseases to flourish, while others have not. These days, most places with persistent pandemics are in what has come to be called the Global South. The burden of epidemic disease has shifted. Tuberculosis, once Europe's leading cause of death, has not disappeared from the earth. It has simply moved. TB declined in the West long before any effective therapy or preventive agent existed. It did so because of public health interventions such as isolation and a generally improved quality of life. TB has increased dramatically in the developing world, even after the discovery of antibiotics, one of modern biomedicine's triumphs, that actually kill it and cure the patient. It has done so because of conditions that allow it to thrive. Unequal access to drugs, crowded living conditions, high rates of infection, and comorbidities like HIV/AIDS, among other things. TB declined in one part of the world without the aid of biomedical interventions, and increased in another part of the planet despite them. None of this means that drugs and medical research are not essential for the control of epidemics. They are, of course. Antiretroviral therapy, an extraordinary discovery by any measure, has been essential in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Yet access has been uneven, and infection rates are rising in some countries. Since its discovery in the 1960s, oral rehydration therapy for cholera has been life-saving, but it does nothing to address the reasons why millions of people in the Global South are drinking water contaminated by human feces. The very simple point is that there is a relationship between disease and social conditions, conditions that do not exist everywhere, and that will not be alleviated with biomedicine. Fear and dread characterize epidemics. Cholera caused considerable panic in the 19th century. Those with HIV/AIDS inspired fear and discrimination in places like the United States in the recent past and into the present. There is still considerable stigma attached to the disease. Plague prompted anti-Jewish pogroms in the 14th century. In our own time, the climate of fear in the United States during the 2014 Ebola pandemic was out of proportion to the actual risk. Yet influenza, which has the capacity to kill untold numbers, the 1918 pandemic killed at least 50 million people in less than a year, seems rarely to occasion much concern. Fearing some diseases and not others is often wrapped up in how a given disease manifests. Cholera is a thoroughly unpleasant disease, the symptoms of which are dramatic and to most sensibilities disgusting, or how it is caused. HIV is tangled up in the complexities of human sexuality. Many have perceived its causes to be rooted in social deviance, including intravenous drug use. A disease's place of origin can have an effect on whether it is feared or not. Malaria is now firmly a tropical disease in the developing world. When it appears occasionally in the developed north, it arrives as a frightening and exotic invader. The question of susceptibility, who gets a disease and why, is important. In early America, colonists considered Indians to be virgin soil for smallpox and other old-world diseases. In the early decades of the 20th century, black South Africans and others were thought to be racially susceptible to TB, while whites could fight infection. That Africans were less susceptible to malaria than colonists led in part to their importation as slaves to the New World in the 17th and 18th centuries. For hundreds of years until the bacteriological revolution, many debated whether or not diseases were contagious or brought on by miasma, the bad air caused by rotting animal and vegetable matter. The plague was often considered to be a punishment for sin. Each of these explanations changed. All of these diseases, save smallpox, are still with us. Only plague, which does still occur, there was an epidemic in India in the 1990s, and it has regular outbreaks in Madagascar, has diminished in scope and ferocity. And new diseases are surely on the horizon. Thus, while much of this book is historical, it is not solely about history. The connection between epidemics and pandemics and the growth of the modern state is clear. As early as the 15th century, in response to the plague, Italian city-states formed state-sponsored boards of health. The cholera pandemics of the 19th century led to nationwide efforts at quarantine, efforts that could only be carried off by a central state. Measures such as compulsory vaccination also demonstrate this connection. Epidemics and pandemics cannot occur without a dense and mobile population. None of these diseases emerged in pandemic form until humans had settled down to farm and begun trading with one another. Infectious diseases need to be transmitted from host to host to survive. That host must be susceptible. Smallpox remained such a killer among American Indians because it was able over centuries to find non-immune populations. Once those populations diminished, the disease naturally declined. Trade and travel were well developed by the 14th century. The plague took advantage of this. TB exploded only when conditions allowed it. The densely packed cities and workplaces of industrializing Europe in the 18th century. AIDS has relied on human mobility to move around the globe. When pandemic influenza spread around most of the planet in a matter of months in 1918, it could only have done so because of the newly built transportation and trade networks and the heightened mobility brought on by World War I. Human, animal, and insect movement are critical in the spread of epidemics and pandemics. Finally, people, eyewitnesses, novelists, poets, memoirists, government bureaucrats, journalists, historians, anthropologists, epidemiologists, kings, queens, and presidents have been writing about epidemics and pandemics for centuries, reflecting on what causes them, what might stop them, and how people have reacted to them. We have collectively accumulated an untold amount of source material of value not only to historians. We have accumulated a record of successes and failures that should be an aid to those working on epidemics and pandemics now. Chapter 1. Plague. Plague. A word more freighted with meaning in the history of disease would be hard to find. It is a disease we now know to be caused by a bacillus, Yersinia pestis, transmitted by the bite of an infected flea, a flea seeking a human host after its animal host died. It first appeared in the 6th century CE, when the first identifiable pandemic occurred during the Byzantine Empire. It is commonly called the Plague of Justinian, after the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian. Where it originated is uncertain. It possibly came from the interior of Central Africa to Ethiopia and went on to Byzantium via well-established trade networks. But it might have come from Asia. We don't know. It first appeared in the historical record in 541 in the Egyptian port city of Pelusium. It took 2 years to travel the length and breadth of the Mediterranean, sparing no country along its coast, moving on to Persia in the east and the British Isles in the north. Although precise demographic data does not exist, it is clear that the pandemic had devastating effects on mortality. John of Ephesus, in his Ecclesiastical History, detailed his encounter with the plague as he coincidentally traveled along its path from Constantinople to Alexandria and back through Palestine, Syria, and Asia Minor. He documented fallow fields, vineyards with grapes unpicked, animals gone feral, and people who spent their days digging graves. The Greek historian Procopius said that plague claimed 10,000 lives in Constantinople in a single day in 1542. The whole human race came near to being annihilated. Evagrius, another contemporary observer, thought the plague took 300,000 lives in the Byzantine capital. These numbers are impressionistic, an impression of deadly devastation. Procopius and other Greek observers of the plague, familiar with earlier epidemics, agreed that there had never been one like the plague of Justinian. Pre-Islamic Arabic writers noted the novelty and reported that the plague had a major demographic effect on the eastern reaches of the Roman Empire. Early Islamic writers chronicled death on such a scale and at such a pace that it forced the abandonment of burial practices. When it finally reached mainland England in the mid-7th century, Bede, in his Ecclesiastical History, lamented that plague's sudden pestilence raged far and wide with fierce destruction and carried off many throughout the length and breadth of Britain. For more than 200 years, beginning with the plague of Justinian, more than a dozen separate epidemics visited parts of Europe and the Near East. By the end of the 8th century, it was gone, perhaps no longer able to find susceptible human or rat hosts. The plague's effects varied from place to place. On a grand scale, the effects of rural depopulation on the finances of the Byzantine Empire, effects gleaned from careful attention to numismatic, papyrological, and legal evidence, suggest that the first plague pandemic might have contributed to the downfall of the empire itself. By contrast, plague did not reach Britain until 664. It disappeared 23 years later. Its immediate impact, mass death, the emptying out of monasteries, the abandonment of villages, was shocking. Its long-term effects might well have been negligible. Northumbrian monastic life was hard hit by the plague in the 660s. 2 generations later, it was thriving. Plague seems to have been no match for good land, royal power, and vast wealth. These conclusions are based on slivers of evidence, for when one tries to look beyond monasteries and into life more generally, documentation disappears. The impact of the plague was keenly felt in the short and long term in Syria. Ships infested with plague arrived from Egypt in 542 at the ports of Gaza, Ashkelon, and Antioch. From there it traveled to Damascus, then spread south. We know from John of Ephesus that it was devastating. From then on, plague struck Syria every 7 years or so between 541 and 749. In the short term, high mortality and mass flight left many places empty. Over the long term, repeated outbreaks had a deleterious effect on agricultural production and the populations of settled communities. The mobile lifestyle of Arabia prevented the plague from taking hold and in turn increased the power of nomadic populations. The continued fragility of agricultural production meant a reduction in crop-based taxes and the rise of a pastoral economy. So frequent was plague in Syria, and so devastating were its effects by early Islamic times, that Syria developed a reputation as a land riddled with plague. The impression stuck. By the medieval period, Islamic Syria was well known as having had a long and disastrous experience with plague. What we do not know about the first pandemic overshadows what we do. This may change as more sophisticated tools of analysis become available. Careful reading of textual sources can get us only so far. Historians will need to draw from disciplines such as zoology, archaeology, and molecular biology if the mysteries of the first pandemic are ever to be revealed. Europe's apparently plague-free centuries came to an end in 1347 when plague returned and took with it up to half of the continent's population, perhaps more. When the first wave of the so-called second pandemic finally fled in 1353, it left in its wake a continent forever changed. After it reappeared in 1347, the plague regularly revisited much of Europe and the Islamic world. Its last European outbreak was in Russia in 1770. The second plague pandemic was not one event. It was a series of epidemics that varied in severity, scale, and scope. For decades, most scholars have believed that plague was introduced once from Central Asia in the middle of the 14th century and then established a reservoir. Recent research into the correlation between changes in the climate in Central Asia and epidemics of plague in Europe suggests the old model might need revision. It is possible that plague came to Europe again and again. When the climate warmed, the Central Asian gerbil population exploded and became a highly mobile, widespread host for fleas. The fleas would then jump to humans and domesticated animals, which would then transport them to Europe at a time of robust trade relations between Asia and European ports such as Dubrovnik. Over the centuries, Europeans adapted to the plague, even came to expect it, and developed ways of dealing with it. As a result, reactions to and consequences of plague in Florence in 1348 were different than they were from the 1665-66 plague in London, for example. Florence experienced a new and novel event. London, as cataclysmic as the plague might have been in the 1660s, experienced a familiar and increasingly well-understood disease. None of this was so during the first pandemic. No one was prepared. No one knew what was happening. It was novel and uniquely deadly. It was the Black Death. For 7 years, plague swept across Europe, devastating the city and the countryside. It first appeared in the historical record in 1346 in the Black Sea port of Kaffa and spread inexorably across Europe. It demanded an explanation. How and why were so many people dying? The how was explained in several overlapping ways: providence, miasma, contagion, and individual susceptibility. As with cholera, these explanations, especially miasma and contagion, would dominate theories of disease transmission until nearly the end of the 19th century. During the Black Death, a time when the late medieval rediscovery of the writings of Galen and Hippocrates, via newly translated Arabic renderings of Greek and Latin texts, was in full flower, and the notion of bad air causing disease flourished, miasma and contagion were not as opposed to one another as they would become. People might become infected because of the miasmatic air seeping up out of the ground as rotting vegetable matter released its toxic gases. They would then be contagious and able to pass the disease on to others, especially those uniquely susceptible, such as sinners and malcontents, the licentious and the gluttonous. These earthly explanations for plague's path were subsumed in what most thought was the ultimate cause of the plague: God's wrath. Before plague reached him, Ralph of Shrewsbury, the Bishop of Bath and Wells, implored his flock to pray. Toward the end of the summer of 1348, he wrote, "Since a catastrophic pestilence from the east has arrived in a neighboring kingdom, it is very much to be feared that unless we pray devoutly and incessantly, a similar pestilence will stretch its poisonous branches into this realm and strike down and consume the inhabitants." Divine explanations were augmented by others. In one of the most detailed contemporary explanations, the masters of the Faculty of Medicine at Paris wrote in October 1348 that the distant and first cause of this pestilence was and is the configuration of the heavens. This conjunction, along with other earlier conjunctions and eclipses, by causing a deadly corruption of the air around us, signifies mortality and famines. When Jupiter and Mars in particular came together, this caused a great pestilence in the air. Jupiter drew vapors out of the earth, Mars ignited them. But even with this scientific explanation, one driven by observation and theory, and devoted to the notion that medicine played a role in controlling the disease, plague was still ultimately caused by God. We must not overlook the fact that any pestilence proceeds from the divine will, and our advice can therefore only be to return humbly to God. Many reacted in horror to the plague, as Giovanni Boccaccio so vividly documents in the Decameron. Based on Boccaccio's experience in Florence, the Decameron is an unparalleled literary representation of the plague's reception. Boccaccio was agnostic on the cause. It might have been the influence of heavenly bodies, or it might have been punishment signifying God's righteous anger at our iniquitous way of life. Whatever the cause, in the face of its onrush, all the wisdom and ingenuity of man were unavailing. All of the advice of physicians and all the power of medicine were profitless and unavailing. The misery caused by plague led people to abandon the laws of God and man. There were few left alive to enforce them. Those outside the city, without medical care or family or community to take care of them, Boccaccio wrote, died more like animals than human beings. Never before had such a calamity struck. The cruelty of heaven, and possibly in some measure also that of man, was so immense and so devastating that between March and July of the year in question, it is reliably thought that over 100,000 human lives were extinguished within the walls of the city of Florence. A French observer noted that half the population of Avignon perished. In Marseille, 4 out of 5 were dead. As the disease traveled through France, the scale of the mortality meant that for fear of death, men did not dare speak with anyone whose kinsman or kinswoman has died, because it has often been observed that when one member of a family dies, almost all of the rest follow. Suspicion and fear were rampant. Family members treated their sick like dogs. Neighbors shunned one another. In city after city, the dead were buried en masse in plague pits, that were an affront to established burial rituals and, at least in the short term, suggest a breakdown of order. Helpless in the face of such death, many chose flight. But in the Muslim world, running from God's will was considered blasphemous. Some searched for scapegoats. Mobs wiped out perhaps as many as 1,000 Jewish communities across Europe. Despite the helplessness many felt, cities such as Venice and Florence responded by creating sanitary commissions. To ensure that the air was pure, they enforced the cleaning of sewers and the collection of garbage. When it seemed clear plague was on its way to Florence, the city forbade those traveling from Genoa or Pisa from entering. When plague did arrive, sanitary regulations sought to effect the removal of all putrid matter and infected persons from which might arise or be induced a corruption of the air. These measures were largely ineffective. Plague came, and it killed. It would be a century or more before anything remotely effective could be put in place, and by then the virulence of the plague had diminished anyway. People who lived through the Black Death reacted in numerous ways. They tried to explain the catastrophe, they reeled in horror, they ran away, they blamed outsiders. What is more difficult to discern are the longer-term effects of the Black Death on demography, the economy, social customs, culture, religion, and so forth. In the near term, the plague decimated a significant portion of the population. One recent estimate is that 60% of Europe perished. Population stayed low for a century, leading to labor shortages, higher wages combined with inflation, and the opening of more land. Depopulation changed for a time some aspects of the social and economic order. This is best documented in England. In 1349, at Ensham Abbey, the dearth of laborers forced the abbot and the lord of the manor to enter into a new labor agreement with the tenants with far more favorable terms. In 1351, the unfree peasants on the estate of John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, were relieved of many of their obligations. On yet another estate, the royal manor of Drakelow in Cheshire, rents were lowered by a third, due, according to the accounting official John de Woodhull, to the effects of the pestilence. The tenants threatened to leave, which would have left the lord's tenements empty, unless they were granted such a remission, to last until the world improves and the tenements came to be worth more. Wages went up, but so too did the cost of almost all basic goods. A demand for labor based on scarcity also meant a scarcity of goods. In response to demands for lower rents and higher wages, Parliament passed the Ordinance of Laborers in 1349 and the Statute of Laborers in 1351 to set wage limits, compel people to work, and punish those who disobeyed. Facing a severe labor shortage, the government acted swiftly against those who attempted to take advantage of the crisis. That laws against seeking higher wages and lower rents were necessary suggests that in the immediate aftermath of the Black Death and in the subsequent decades of the 14th century, there was a perceptible change in mentalité. Elite commentary on the much-maligned behavior of the peasantry bears this out. They used their newfound surplus to purchase clothes not befitting their station in life. They also increasingly took up hunting, once the exclusive enclave of the rich. The poet John Gower lamented the passing of the old ways. The laborers of olden times were not accustomed to eat wheat bread. Their bread was made of beans and of other corn, and their drink was water. Then cheese and milk were a feast to them. Rarely had they any other feast than this. Their clothing was plain gray. Then was the world of such folk well-ordered in its estate. But now our happy times of old have been rudely wiped out, because servants are now masters and masters are servants. The peasant pretends to imitate the ways of the free men and gives himself the appearance of him in his clothes. Sumptuary laws directed at the outrageous and excessive apparel of diverse people against their estate and degree also suggest that peasant behavior was markedly changing. Lamentations for times past, when people knew their station in life, were common in the decades after the Black Death. Despite the presence of laws forbidding both demanding and paying excess wages, the practice was common. In the face of a continued labor shortage made worse by subsequent epidemics in 1360-62 and 1369, there was often no other choice. Laborers in Italy demanded higher wages, too. In Florence, the chronicler Matteo Villani noted that serving girls and unskilled women with no experience in service and stable boys won at least 12 florins per year, and the most arrogant among them 18 or 24.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?